Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ann Patchett, whose latest novel is Run. Earlier novels include Bel Canto, The Magician's Assistant, Taft, The Patron Saint of Liars, and a nonfiction book, a memoir, Truth and Beauty. Ann Patchett, this book, Run, continues along certain lines. In an old interview, someone asked you the question about The Magician's Assistant. It talks about how you write often about families coming together, which I think you corrected to strangers coming together and becoming family.
Yes.
But in the case of Run, it is about a family coming together.
Yes, yes. And some of the members of that family are strangers to one another, and then they find each other through the course of the book.
It takes place in Boston, and it involves a former Boston mayor and his two adopted children, his one real son, and some other characters. Is the character of Bernard Doyle, the mayor, based on anyone specifically?
Well, the question would be, is he Joe Kennedy? And certainly he's not Joe Kennedy, but it was inspired in a way. I remember when I was first working on this book, I was reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, and I was so fascinated by Joe Kennedy as this figure who just kept pitching his boys out like baseballs. You know, he was going to have a kid who was going to be the president of the United States. And so I wanted to write a book about a father who's political, who's trying to raise a son to political office, but is failing with every son, as opposed to Joe Kennedy, who really succeeded with every son.
It's a big jump from that to a 24-hour period in the lives of these people. Did you know when you were looking at the book exactly what the form would be, how it would take shape? At what point did you go from thinking Kennedy to thinking adoption to thinking 24-hour period?
You know, these books bake so slowly in the back of my mind, and I am somebody who puts it all together really before I started writing it, but I can take it back to when I was 19 years old and I was at summer school at Harvard. I had a boyfriend who studied ichthyology. There's a character in this book who studies fish at Harvard. I was always so fascinated by the idea of being that smart and studying dead fish. So I can trace the origins of the book all the way back to that.
And the story of the adoption, a white mayor adopts black children.
Yeah, this isn't a book about race, really. It's much more a book about class. I wanted it to be an interracial adoption because I didn't want it to be a book about the moment you discover you were adopted. You know, let's have this on the table right now. These kids are adopted. It could have been a couple of Chinese girls, I guess, and that would have been fine, too. I wanted to say there's a difference between the family that you have, the family that you go out and find and bring into your world, and then the people who come to you that you, in fact, don't want and that you have to take responsibility for anyway.
The real son, the actual son, Sullivan, is kind of a problematic character, and it emerges why he had to leave, why he had to return. Did you know those backstories before you sat down and wrote the book, or did they come up organically?
No. I mean, they came up organically, but they came up organically before I sat down to write the book. And I actually spent a long time trying to figure out exactly what it is that Sullivan was doing in Africa. I wanted him to be involved in some nefarious business. He's in trouble, maybe not enormous trouble, but he's still in trouble, and trying to figure out where in Africa he would be. I actually researched that a lot. I kept emailing people and saying, you know, I'm looking for a job for a character, and finally came up with one.
In talking to a lot of writers, it seems that aside from writing the book, dealing with voice and the perspectives, you know, first person, second person, omniscient narrator, all of that, it seems that a lot of novel writing is puzzle solving.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, in Run, what did you find were the biggest puzzles you had to solve? And without giving the plot away, how did you solve them?
I love that aspect of writing, and that's very much how I think about a whole lot of writing. A lot of what I do in every book, and this is just for myself, is I solve some problem that I felt that I didn't solve in the previous book. So Bel Canto is a book about the suspension of time. The character gives away his watch, they're lost in a fog, they don't know the season, they're cut off from everything, and they live this very organic life without time. So by the end of the book, I was a little tired of the suspension of time. I wanted to take responsibility for time. So I thought, okay, now I want to write a book that really runs like a Swiss watch, and you could take the back of it off and see every cog sets in motion another cog, and that I am accountable to the clock. There's the character of Sullivan, who's just come in from Africa, who has jet lag. There's another character, Tennessee, who's in the hospital, who wakes up intermittently in drug-induced comas. And because of that, basically I have seven characters, but one of them is always awake. It's an omniscient narration. So the point of view passes to whoever happens to be awake at that moment. That was very puzzling and a lot of fun to work out.
Was there any time where you said, damn, okay, I have to go back. I've hit a brick wall and I need to solve this problem, and how am I going to do it?
Yeah, but I do that at the beginning. I mean, I'll rewrite the first 50 pages of a book 50 times. For me, it's like getting the basement right. Once I get the first part of it right, I go faster and faster and faster. When I'm starting a book, that's where I do all my rewriting and have all my misery. I feel like I'm trying to break into Fort Knox with an emery board. I mean, I know that it's in there. I know the story's in there, but I don't know how to get in, and I hit my head against the wall over and over again. It is not a case for me that I ever get to page 200 and look back to page 15 and think, ah, there's the critical error. That's where I should have gone left. Or I have to throw out everything back to page 15 and start over again from that point.
The crux of the book at the beginning sits on a statue, and we come back to the statue later on. Was that the solving of a puzzle? Was that a way in some way for you?
No, actually. I have a very close friend who's a novelist, Elizabeth McCracken, who wrote The Giant's House and Niagara Falls All Over Again, and is the only person who reads my work while I'm working on it and is my editor, and I am hers. So when I sent her the first 75 pages of this book, the scene with the statue was the beginning of chapter 3 and was much shorter. And she said, take this out of chapter 3, move it to the front of the book, and make it longer, because this is actually how you're setting your tone. And in terms of the structure, it does really work, because the book takes place in 24 hours, but the story of the statue establishes the history of the family and takes place outside the time of the novel. So that was just a really good piece of advice.
I guess the first thing you did is you set up the main character of Doyle, his three sons, Kenya, the black girl, and her mother. And from there, you began working outward. Is that about it?
You know, it's hard to say, because it's really not a linear process. I'm a very linear writer, but in those years, and I mean years, that I was thinking about this book. Originally, this was a book about science, and it took place in Princeton. You know, and then it slowly evolves. You know, maybe it's more about religion. No, it's not really about religion. No, it's about politics. And, you know, and one step takes me to the next, until finally I have that puzzle solved in my head. And when I have the structure down, then I sit down to write it. And that's where the real misery begins.
Well, is this the same way that you found yourself writing Bel Canto, too?
Bel Canto was different because it was based on a true story. So I really was handed a structure from the newspaper. And I, you know, made decisions. I'm going to add an opera singer. I'm going to add the whole thing about language and music. The problem with writing Bel Canto, and that was a book that took me forever too, is there are all of these scenes that have to happen, but they don't have to happen in any particular order. It's just the opposite of run. One scene of Bel Canto doesn't inform the other. So at any point, I would finish a chapter and think, all right, I know there are four things that have to happen next. One in the kitchen, one in the closet, one in the den, one outside. But I had no idea what order they happened in. There wasn't that compelling sense of time to push me forward. It was a very easy book to sort of put down, stick in a drawer, walk away from.
Once you had the structure down of run, I know that from my little experience working on unpublished material, once I get momentum going, once I know, okay, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, the writing almost gets very fast, because the book gets very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Did that happen to you?
Not till the end.
Really?
And that's true with all my books. I always say I'm like the horse that sees the barn. You know, once I can really see that I'm within fighting distance of the end of the story, then I can go very fast. But I am unbelievably slow at the beginning.
Ann Patchett, the interrelationship, how these people are actually related to each other, how did that emerge?
I know that I wanted to write about my exhaustion with the phrase family values. to me, the whole structure of the family is about a social structure and a political structure. One thing that was a surprise as I was working on the book was I really didn't think about the character of Kenya until I started, because I thought the only thing worse than having your mother give you up for adoption is to find out that she, in fact, had another kid that she didn't give up for adoption. So I put in this extra child as a sort of twist of the knife. But, in fact, she becomes a very beloved character and the glue. She is literally the person who animates the family. They're very isolated. They're in a jar. There's a scene early on in the book where she picks up a jar of Tip's dead fish and shakes them, kind of makes them swim again. And that's really what she's doing with the Doyle family.
In terms of philosophical themes, you are talking about politics. You're talking about family. The character of Teddy learns along the way the importance of making moral choices and taking stands. In terms of you as a writer, do you feel you have any responsibility in the same way?
Sure, I do, of course, because I have an audience. I mean, I have people's ear. And even though I don't write for readers, I really write for myself. I write the story that I want to hear. I know from the experience of Bel Canto the power of book clubs and people getting together and discussing ideas that they come upon in a novel, and then they go off into their own life through those platform discussions. So if I can put in front of somebody, what's your social responsibility? Is it enough if you're really smart and have had every privilege? Is it enough to study dead fish? Or do you have some responsibility to give back something to your community? Is it enough to follow just your own interests and desires? What's sacrifice? Part of the structure of this book is that parents all make enormous sacrifices for their children, and they give their children these perfect lives, and they're wonderful children, but they're children who have no interest in making any sacrifices because they just aren't called upon. They have a beautiful, fantastic life. Why should they want to make any sacrifices?
But again, at the same time, these children are all too young to have children themselves.
It's true, but, you know, this is the age where we start to shape our lives and we start to think about what we're going to do, what our responsibilities are. So these are things I don't have the answer for, but they are, I think, valuable questions to put out there and hope that people do talk about them.
Well, when you're talking about this younger generation of Kenya, Sullivan, and the Teddy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when you're talking about this younger generation versus the older generation, not merely Tennessee, who's closer to your age, but also Doyle, the patriarch, who's much older. When you're talking about that, I wonder, is it just any generation, or is this particular younger generation less inclined than previous ones?
No, I think it's any generation, because I think that you can go back to Socrates and find people saying, find Socrates saying, this younger generation, they're never going to amount to anything. They're not willing or able to take on the mantle of responsibility. These are questions that have been with us since the beginning of time. I don't think that our younger generation is probably any worse than the younger generation before it. It's just their taste in music is worse.
Well,
that's the other half of it, right? You know, we don't think that they can step up to the plate and their music is hideous. That's what it means to be young.
But our music was hideous, too.
Exactly.
It's funny that in the context of Run, you're so concerned about time, yet when the book actually takes place is extremely vague. We do know that someone has an Obama in 12 sign. That's all we know. We don't really have a specific date, or did you?
No, I mean, I think of it as just the present.
Okay.
Just now. I mean, they're talking about Clinton, they're talking about Jackson. Bush's name doesn't appear in the book, but it's certainly the impetus for a lot of the conversation. And in fact, I kept going back to Harvard when I was doing research for this book, and the place where the accident takes place on Elliott Street, there's a dorm on the other side of the street, and there was an Obama 2012 sign in that window. This was before Obama was even thinking about running. And I actually considered at the last minute changing it, making it an Obama 08 sign. And I thought, no, you know what? That was a 2012 sign. I'm going to leave that alone.
The decision to keep other political features of the landscape, like a rock, out of it.
Yeah, it's true. I think that it was really a matter of wanting to talk about these things like sacrifice, like responsibility, in a way, hopefully, that would be a little more timeless than just what's going on now. And I didn't want it to turn into a novel that would vent my rage against the current political administration.
You do have this interest, I guess, in doppelgangers of a sort. You have two characters named Sullivan. This is pointed out by John Updike in The New Yorker. Two characters named Sullivan, an older man and a younger man. The two black mother and daughter are named after places, Kenya and Tennessee, and Tip and Teddy are named after politicians.
Well, yes, and the original parents in the family were Bernard and Bernadette Doyle. I don't know. It's my little Garcia Marquez moment. And it's the thing that I love so much about 100 Years of Solitude. There are only four names. They just use them over and over again. And so I thought, okay, great. I'll work from a very small palette of names.
You're listening to an interview with Ann Patchett, whose latest novel is Run. Speaking of that, in one interview I found, someone asked you, what book changed your life? And you did say 100 Years of Solitude. How do you think that informs a book like Run, beyond these unconscious little seeds that you plant of names? Where do you think it places in terms of Run, or in terms of Patron Saint of Liars, or in terms of Bel Canto?
You know, they're the books that influence you, and then they're the books that you really wish had influenced you. And I think that I really wish 100 Years of Solitude had influenced me. I think that the book that really influenced me the most was probably The Magic Mountain, which I read at 16. It has so much to do with when you read it. But actually, 100 Years of Solitude is similarly about isolation. It's about a group of people who are cut off from the rest of the world. Their society has its moment in time to thrive, and then it's blown apart. That's very much a Magic Mountain story. Those are the stories that I gravitate to.
Well, that obviously explains Bel Canto. I mean, at another point you talk about how a very important film for you is The Poseidon Adventure, which is not that odd, because a lot of science fiction books are arc novels. They take place on an arc, how people interact. And in a way, that's what this is too, or that's what a lot of your books are.
I had this moment. I saw The Poseidon Adventure when it came out, and I'm not sure of the math, but I think I was 10 or 11. And it was the first time that I actually thought of how something was plotted. Take a group of people, they're right side up, they're happy, turn their world upside down, make them crawl from the bottom to the top that used to be the bottom, and then see who dies along the way and take out the winners. It was just so incredibly clear. And so, yes, The Poseidon Adventure, remarkably like Mons, The Magic Mountain.
But then you come to something like Run, which is set in a city with other characters, and yet at the same time, there's a certain art quality to it.
There is, and I think that has to do with the snow, with the whole claustrophobia. You get the feeling that these people don't ever get very far away from each other. The title, of course, has to do with literally running. Kenya is a runner, politically running. They're running for mayor. But also that desire to run away from your family, to just run out of there, and which I think that all of the people in the book feel.
Do you think that living, I don't want to say an isolated life, but a life isolated from the literary community in Tennessee gives you some kind of special insight into the idea of being in a space where you kind of feel trapped?
No, I don't. I love having a quiet life, and actually, if I could choose anything, I would probably choose some place that was much, much more isolated. I would go to eastern Wyoming or something like that and live in the middle of nowhere. The duller my life is, the more work I could get done. My friend Dorothy Allison once said to me, you have to have necessary boredom. You've got to get bored enough to want to tell yourself a story. And I think that that's really true. If I lived in New York and was invited to interesting parties every night, what would I ever get done?
Why did you name Tennessee the mother after the place where you live?
A couple of reasons. One, I think it's a burdensome name, and that becomes important in the story of how she picks up this name. It's not a beautiful name. It's not a name anybody would want. It's a name that's always going to draw attention to you. But the character's name is Tennessee Mosier. It's really named for my friend Barry Mosier, who is the great illustrator, who was born in Chattanooga and shares a lot of the characteristics of this character, even though he is a a bald white guy in his 60s. He is, in fact, Tennessee Mosher.
The book Truth and Beauty concerns your memoir of a friendship with writer Lucy Greeley, who had a very difficult life and died under very sad circumstances in 2002. This is the first novel you've written since she passed away. How do you think that entire sequence of events influenced a book like Run?
I was writing Run before Lucy died. When she died, I put it aside and wrote Truth and Beauty and then came back to it and didn't change my mind about the structure and what I was saying and who the characters were, but I hated what I had written. And I threw it away, and I started over again in the exact same place at the same moment in the story, but just trying to write it better. And then I did Best American Short Stories. I wrote a book with a friend. I kept stopping this book, and every time I would go back, I would think, ugh, that's awful. You know, it's not right. It's not right. And I would start over again. And I think that those delays actually made it a much better book, because the longer I have to spend with a set of characters, the more I know them, the deeper I get into them.
Well, what were some of these mistakes that you finally just threw out? Can you give a couple of them?
It's so odd, and I'm not somebody who keeps things, but for some reason I found the first drafts of those chapters on my computer when I was at the end of writing the final version. Nothing had changed. Nothing had changed in terms of the characters, the actions, when they arrive, when they leave, the basic conversations they're having. It's just that the writing was really bad. I think it had to do with the fact that I was writing more from my head than I was from my heart. I was writing from a place of not deeply understanding these people yet. I just wasn't ready to write the book yet. I had the story, but I wasn't close enough to the characters yet.
Had Lucy Greeley seen any versions of this book? Had you communicated any of that to her?
No. Lucy and I were funny. I mean, we were best friends, but we didn't overlap a whole lot in terms of writing. I, by Lucy's standards, was prolific. Now, by anybody else's standards, I wasn't. But Lucy was the most tortured writer. Nobody hated to write more than Lucy. And I wasn't about to go to her and say, oh, here, this is what I'm working on. Because it just made her feel bad about her own productivity. She was proud of me, but I think that it was important for us to keep the writing sort of separate.
In Truth and Beauty, you're willing to say what she said to you, sometimes very hurtful things.
Mm-hmm.
Was that particularly difficult?
You know, I started writing that book 3 weeks after she died, and it is such an incredibly uncalculated book. I never thought, I'm going to look this way, she's going to look this way. If I wrote this book now, I would want to spin it and control it. I would think, this is what people are going to think about this. But it was, at that moment, a desire to just write down what happened as fast as I could so I would always have that part of her. I would have that memory clear. I was giving a reading someplace, Virginia, I think it was, last week, and a woman stood up and said, oh, our book club read Truth and Beauty, an autobiography of a face, and half of us just hated you by the time we were over. It's everybody's entitled to their opinion.
Have you gone back and looked at it more recently?
I've never read any of my books.
Really?
No.
Well, what happens when you go to a reading, and yeah, someone says, read X chapter?
No one's ever said that. I mean, I have my thing that I read in every book. And usually it takes a while to kind of hone it down. You read a couple of different parts, you find the right one, and then that's it. I stick. And I always go back and read that part, which is good because it means I get better and better at it. And it's sort of like a performance. I wonder if maybe when I'm in assisted living, if I'll sit down with the big stack of Patchett books and read them again. I don't know. It seems too excruciating to look back. Not that I think that they're bad, but I just don't want to look back on my life in that way. I did the audio tape for Truth and Beauty, and you talk about something I could never listen to, the sound of my own voice reading my own book. No way.
Ann Patchett, as you mentioned before earlier in the interview, this book is more about class than race, but there is race in there. How careful were you, and how careful should a writer be when dealing with an issue like race, do you think? A white writer dealing with black people.
You know, I wrote this book, Bel Canto, and nobody ever once said to me, you know, how should you deal with writing about middle-aged Japanese businessmen? How should you write about Peruvian teenage boys? You know, write about white Americans and black Americans in the same book, and everybody's like, hey, is this okay? Is this all right?
Well, that's why I asked.
Yeah. Race is the central part of our country. It is our conflict. It is our character. It is our strength. It is what makes us Americans. There is no way in the world that I am not going to write about race. I also believe there are no limits on the imagination. I am not writing about myself in my novels. I'm writing about people who are outside of me. And so nobody can say, well, you're allowed to write about Japanese men, but you're not allowed to write about black men. You know, you can write about women, but you can't write about men. You can't write about children because you don't have any children. That's just ridiculous. Now, you can tell me that I've done a bad job, and that's fair, but you can't tell me that I'm not allowed to go there. I can't imagine not being interested in the issues of race and class in this country and wanting to talk about them.
But it does bring up the question of self-censorship in terms of that. I mean, how do you put that aside and just deal with writing? And this would include the Japanese businessman going, how do I get myself into the head of a Japanese businessman who's, you know, being held captive by a bunch of Peruvian gorillas?
I'm a trained professional. I mean, this is what I do. I don't sing. I don't run. I don't play the piano. I'm not a Japanese businessman. I'm not a black ichthyologist at Harvard. My job is to imagine other things. This is the job of fiction, both as writing fiction and reading fiction. It is a compassionate act. It is an act of empathy. It is the act of imagining the other and encouraging readers to go outside their own skin and imagine other people and other lives. That's the whole point of this business.
One thing I've been asking, I've been interested in, you know, certain topics interest me, and I just ask everybody that year those mm-hmm. topics. But lately I've been interested with the difference between being truthful in sense and being authentic in fact, and what happens when the two conflict.
It's just not a problem that I've come up against.
Really?
I know what you're saying, but of course in fiction, you know, it's fiction, and I'm making everything up. I don't write Romana Clefs. You're never going to know anything more about my personal life by reading my books.
But you're also not going to have an African elephant running down the streets of Boston in a snowstorm either. I mean, you're going to try to keep levels of verisimilitude.
Absolutely. When you write a novel, you are essentially God, right? You decide when people are born, when they die, when they fall in love. You're the set designer. You're the costume designer. What you have to be to write a good novel, I believe, is consistent. So you work out the rules of that universe, and you must be consistent. If in this universe there are elephants running down Boston streets in snowstorms, that's okay, but they can't just make one brief appearance. You know, then that's a whole other world, like a Harry Potter world, and you follow that logic all the way through.
And in a sense, then, there is no difference between a fantasy, a semi-fantasy, and a novel that takes place explicitly in this, in our world, because you're still inventing something.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there's also the question of what is invented to me and what is invented to you. There's a priest in this book who may or may not be able to heal people.
And there's a ghost.
There's a ghost, but maybe that has to do with anesthesia. You know, maybe that's a dream. And a lot of it is what people feel comfortable with. I am a Catholic. I spent 12 years in Catholic school. I went to chapel every morning and prayed the rosary on my knees in front of a carved piece of rock that I worshipped. I believed all those stories in Butler's Lives of the Saints. I was raised to believe that the world was bigger than what I could see, that things that I couldn't understand were possible. And that went a long way to inform my fiction writing.
And it still does. Once you've thrown out certain parts of that, I'm not saying you throw out the baby in the bathwater, but once you throw out large segments of it, what remains seems to come more from the unconscious. How much of that is conscious now?
You know, it's just ingrained in you. In the same way, if you had a paper route, your family rituals, your relationships with your siblings, you know, all of the things you do over and over again as a child, as you're growing up, are the things that shape you. And when I say the Magic Mountain shaped me, it's because I read it at 16. If I had read it at 40, it wouldn't have affected me in the same way. That's just in my wood grain now. It's part of who I am. If you put me under a bright light right now in a chair and said, okay, Patchett, do you believe that if you crumble up a crust of bread and throw it to the little birds, that every one of those little birds will bring back a piece of grain that will fill up your sacks 20-fold? You know, of course, intellectually, I would say no, but emotionally, those stories are who I am, and I can't deny them.
Ann Patchett, one other thing that you are is a professional writer, and you spent many years writing for 17 magazine. You even wrote for Bridal Guide.
I was a contributing editor for Bridal Guide.
Whoa. How important do you think it is for a writer? I know it was important for you to develop skills through freelance writing. We talk about going to writing classes or being in a writing program. You were in Iowa. But what about just the idea of developing skills as a journalist, whether it be writing for 17 magazine or for a blog?
Well, and I would like to say I have since written for Harper's and The Atlantic and The New York Times. It wasn't all 17 in Bridal Guide. Everybody comes to their own education in their own way. When I got out of school, I taught. I taught college off and on for years. And at some point, I realized this is so much more work for the money that I'm trying to make to support my habit of writing novels, that I can write magazine work in a fraction of the time, make as much money, and then get back to work on what's important to me. I think that I have learned a lot from my career as a journalist, and I use that term very loosely. Part of it is I know how to take criticism. I know how to get things done and turn it around on short order. I know how to not be sentimental about my own work and just wanting to make it the very best. I developed my ear because I could write for Vogue and for GQ and for Mademoiselle and 17 and Gourmet and any magazine and know the difference by reading it once in what the tone is. You're going to write something for Oprah? You're going to write something for Real Simple? Those are different magazines, and you're going to have to fix your voice in a different way. So all of those things, working fast, getting things in on time, were very important lessons. I don't necessarily think that it is the one true path to being a novelist.
It does teach you also that, in a way, there's no such thing as writer's block.
I actually am not a big fan of writer's block anyway. I have so many friends who are writers, and I'm always saying, I'll set you up with my editor. I'll get you this job. It's so easy. It's good money. It goes really fast. And they're tortured by it. They freeze. It takes them 6 months to write the piece. But I think that especially those years of 17 where I was just churning it out every week, I don't get writer's block, and I especially don't get it from magazine work.
Ann Patchett, Patron Saint of Liars did become a TV movie that you've distanced yourself from.
No, I haven't.
No, you haven't?
No, not at all. I'm very warm-hearted about that TV movie.
Were you involved with it at all?
I went for a couple of days. It was funny. I really wanted to go for the whole thing. Because I am a bonder, I had become friends with the screenwriter and the producer, and I knew all these people, and I was like, oh, I want to go for the whole time. They were out on location in the middle of nowhere in North Carolina, and the screenwriter kept saying, you will only last 2 days. This is so boring. You'll never make it. No, it's my movie. It's not going to be boring. And I made it 2 days, and I ran screaming. It was the most boring thing. It was like being trapped at a mediocre cocktail party for 14 hours a day.
And any interest in Bel Canto? Are they making a film?
Oh, who knows? There's a wonderful producer who I have, of course, bonded with and love very much, Caroline Barron, who made Capote. She has the rights to it. It has come so close so many times. It's like herding cats, you know.
How do you feel about the reaction, just beyond a certain amount of pride, in the fact that Bel Canto grew and grew, was like the little book that could?
It's great. I mean, and it really makes one very hopeful. It's also strange, too, because there's another side to that, which is I have people come up to me all the time and said, I didn't read Bel Canto for 5 years because everybody told me that I should, and I would never read a book that was that popular. I'm way too cool to read popular fiction. And all of a sudden, I think, since when do I write popular fiction? This is about Peru and opera and terrorism. Yeah, it just caught on. And a lot of that had to do with when it came out. You know, it's like The Kite Runner. Now, I think that it was a book that hit at the right time, and there were people who had things they really needed to get together and talk about, and these are the books that gave people a forum to do it.
Any interest from Hollywood yet on Run?
Yeah, actually. And the deal is not signed, but it's something that I'm very excited about. I swore no more movie options, never again. I'm not going down this road. And then this woman called me, and I was so interested in her. She was terrific, and I thought, okay, yeah, for you, I want to make a movie. So.
But you understand you kind of, it's their work, it's not yours.
I totally understand that, yeah.
Ann Patchett, are you working on another novel? Is it going to take another 6 years?
Well, it depends on if I write a couple of other books in the interim, I guess. But I hate that because it makes it sound like I was watching television and eating chocolates for the last 6 years. But I'm thinking about another book. I don't have any idea if it's the book that I actually will wind up writing or where it will go, but I've always got something in the back of my mind.
You've been listening to an interview with Ann Patchett, whose latest novel is Run. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.